I talk just about all day, every day, and almost every night, and I often disagree with myself. As all of you know, you can't talk a whole hour and have it all be true. No way. I think if so, you're made a vice president of something. As you well know, everybody's motivated. The challenge that you and me have is if they're motivated in a different direction than we think that they ought to be going, then they're going. That's where our challenge. And that's not a motivational problem, but really basically a leadership problem. The leadership problem is that you have to create the desire in others to want what it is you got, then not give it to them and teach them how to get it. But what most of us do is the opposite. We create often the desire in others to want what it is that we got, and then we give it to them. The people we give it to lose it, don't they get it back, and then they hate the people that gave it to them. So. As most of you know, motivation is really a byproduct of meaningful encounters with the exigencies of life. And if you seek to be motivated per se, it really is axiomatic as demotivation rather than motivational. Then somebody from Asia takes over another business in the U.S. So I don't mean anything. I don't mean anything to be motivational, like in the classical sense. I heard two or three of you. I've been trying to spot you, but I can't find you. But I heard you out there saying, "I think we're now going to get motivated." These two people look like they could use it, but I can't find you. Maybe they didn't come back. But anyway.
By the way, somebody said to Walt, "How do you get rich?" He said, "Find something no one wants and make it valuable by what you do to it."
She's 23, and she graduated, some of you know, from Santa Clara. And Vanessa says, "Dad, why do you and mother have dishes in a cupboard?" I said, "What?" She said, "You have 12 dishes in a cupboard with a light on it." And she said, "Dad, you got one shelf that has one cup with a light on it. What is the purpose of that?" You hear this question? Called an intelligent question. I said, I don't know. She said, "Dad, people don't come over and say, 'Could I see that cup on that top shelf?'" I said, "Well, what would you do?" She said, "Dad, give us the silver and the crystal to use every day. We like silver and crystal. Your children, we don't like Donald Duck cups and Mickey Mouse dishes and old scratched up plastic. Give us the silver and the crystal." So we did. By the way, our Donald Duck cups and Mickey Mouse dishes, worth a fortune. I'm serious, they put all away. Our silver's worth nothing.
Mike began speaking and communicating during his high school years with a radio talk show called Teen Talk, which made him a pioneer broadcaster at an early age. He then continued his career in communications by producing and directing his own television talk show called Men at the Top. Mike Vance worked for 7 years with the Disney organization. He was in charge of idea and people development for Walt Disney Productions, Disneyland, and Walt Disney World. He was also dean of Disney University, which is considered one of the world's most outstanding training centers. Walt Disney said, "Mike is one of the most creative guys I've met. He will take you down new roads, no matter how many you've been down before." He co-founded the Creative Thinking Association of America, which seeks out, studies, and shares creative techniques and the best practices of highly creative people through his lectures, seminars, creative celebrations, and Think Out of the Box newsletters.
I wish Walt Disney were here to talk to you this morning. I know you do too. I'll try to bring you as much of Walt's flavor in the hour I have with you. You'd like him a lot. Walt Disney was a little guy. He was only about 5'6" and a half. He was very shy. He was very introverted. As a matter of fact, when you first met Walt, he reminded you a great deal of an accountant, except when he talked, something came out, so you knew. Well, if there are any accountants here, you know what I'm talking about. Walt, I don't know if any of you have ever had a chance to meet him or a chance to see him, but I was talking to one of you. I was actually the third person that Walt Disney sent to Orlando. I was the third person here on the site in the late 1960s, myself and an attorney, naturally, and a vice president of operations. They're always got their nose in there. Anyway, the three of us came down here. You all must know how it makes me feel to walk around here now and to look what happened. Because when I started, I was saying to my associates who were with me today that there was nobody here. We used to fish here when I'm telling you that the fish had never seen a person. And so I started here a long time ago, and one of the things that why we began so early was to try to come down here and to build the culture, which we felt would be quite different than we had in California, and that we'd have to do it different than we'd done it here. Then, as some of you here are cognizant, we had a really challenging situation occur, which was right in the middle of this project down here, Walt died. And some of you I know that. And when he died, that, you know, really was, it really hurt all of us a lot because we liked him. Sometimes the leader dies and everybody goes, shit, that's great. He's gone. Well, you know, some leaders are like that. But he wasn't. He was just the opposite. He actually liked him. Some of you who know me know I have 7 children that I know of. And if any of you here... Well, I'm sure about most of them, but if any of you here have a lot of children or are going to, you have to get very realistic about what you do, you know, as you know, very quickly. And that was what was a great break to be able to work for Walt, because he knew how to get stuff done. And if all you got to do is walk around here and see how he understood that. And he did it really through not managing one of the themes of your conference here. But he did it through real leadership, because he didn't believe in manager with your foot on the control and the foot on the brake and telling everybody what to do. Walt was the opposite. Even though he was very definitive about what it was that he believed in, what it was that he wanted, he absolutely freed people, said, get the foot off the brake, don't be managers, be leaders, and give it the gas. Which, by the way, Jack Welch, I had the opportunity to start working with Jack Welch in the late 1970s, as he became the chairman of General Electric, because he wanted to try to get some of the Disney culture into that old manufacturing company. And that was one of the things that he picked up on from Walt, which was the idea that moved from trying to manage and control people to try to lead and inspire people, because your net results will be greater, especially today that technology has removed all the layers in between, that to keep the old organizational forms in place actually causes you not to do as well, even with new high technologies, as you did before them. And see, Jack Welch saw that in 1978-79, and Walt was anticipating that way back. So if he were here, by the way, you would like him. And I want to acknowledge that up above here, there should be a sign that says Walt Disney, because much of what I am, I owe the good luck I had to work with him. And one of the things I think is so important, when Walt died, we were trying to figure out how were we going to take the culture, how are we going to convey to people the spirit that was Walt Disney. I don't know if any of you guys have ever tried to capture somebody's spirit, you know, and transfer it to another group of people. And, you know, you can't do it with BS. It's got to be something very sincere. So we were trying to figure out symbolically, you know, what we could do. And one of the things that we decided is that we had to get something that symbolized Walt. Because I don't know if any of you here ever studied him very much, but he was never a president of the Disney Company. He was never on the board of directors. And people used to ask, well, why aren't you president of the Disney Company? He said, I own it. Well, he said, I can't figure out people want to be president of anything because you have to work with attorneys and sign your name. And he said, I don't like any of that. So that's why he never really was. He saw his role as primarily that of teacher. That when you move from managing and controlling to leading and inspiring, you shift your role to become primarily a teacher. And that Walt, I would say, out of his long days, he must have spent at least 8 or 10 hours in what we would classically call the training and the development function. Because he said that's where the action is, that's where your growth is, that's where you really improve on performance. And that's how, as he mentioned in my introduction, I was so lucky. I was the dean of Disney University, the first one, helped to put it together and develop all the training programs at Disneyland. And then here, we didn't get to Paris. don't blame that on me. But anyway, so if you think about all of those are examples of how Walt Disney got people involved, how he kept them informed, and you can see also what the end results were. And the end results were something unique. And probably more than any other thing, that is what you try to do whenever you're trying to improve whatever it is that you're up to think out of the box. There's another on the wall, if you can picture that wall. There is another thing on the wall behind the curtain at Disney Studio that's part of how to think out of the box. The other thing that's on the wall are what we call 9 fundamental questions. 9 fundamental questions about how to think out of the box. And I wanted to tell you what these 9 fundamental questions are. Easy to remember. I used to sometimes, some of you remember my talking about the 9 concepts, but I like to refer to them as the 9 fundamental questions. Here's the first fundamental question. That whenever you want to think out of the box and do really well at anything, you have to really evaluate the way things are. Because when you evaluate the way things are, you will always then start looking at the needs. And when you start looking at the needs, because you're looking at the way things really are, is where you can have an opportunity to be creative, which is the making of the new and the rearranging the older way. The second fundamental question is, why are things the way they are? And when you ask the question, why are things the way they are, you get at the causes. The third fundamental question is, how do we do something about it? Because when you ask that question, then you start dealing with the effect. The fourth of these fundamental questions is, the question is, are we being realistic? And you have to ask yourself, are you really being valid in your thinking or not? Then the next fundamental question is, are you promoting and are you open to change?
Mike was a student of the late Frank Lloyd Wright, who influenced his thoughts about design. He also worked with Buckminster Fuller, the inventor of the geodesic dome. Mike's environmental design firm, Vance Design, is well known for developing unique and effective creative environments. For example, team centers and creative living centers called Kitchens for the Mind. Those who have come to be motivated find that Mike goes a step beyond by assuming them to be already motivated. He makes his audiences excited to be alive as a part of what he refers to as a universe filled with integrity in which man is continuously discovering general principles. His dynamic style hits home hard with a wealth of how-to information geared to get things accomplished in the home or office. Mike Vance translates his experiences into easy, workable techniques for improving performance.
That is, I want to give you the quote that Mr. Wright, he said, "We have very few inferior people anywhere in the world. What we have are inferior environments." And what you want to do as much as you can is to enrich the place. Here it is. If you will enrich the environment, that is the major key. And I would like, if I might, to show you just a second how to do that. Then number 2 is that you have to have a way to work with people and a methodology to communicate with people that will keep them informed so that they will cooperate. And by the way, in the book, you're all going to have a copy of, I talk about how do you do that. And then the last one, the product or the services that you create, one of the keys has to be this inspirational piece in there in order for it to create. So see, this became the formula. That one of the things, let me write down so you'll have it, that what we said, we want to get C3. And Jack Welch said, that's what I want. I want committed people that are really collaborating and working together with strength so that we can create a new company. And the way we'll get that is to have a vision, or if you like the word mission statement, but make it really work. And how do you make a mission or vision statement really work? By designing into it its method. This would be a major point. To have a good mission or vision statement, it has to have intrinsic to it the methodology. How do you do it?
Mike's content topics are tailored and customized to fit a specific need, theme, or convention program. Background information is gathered for blending and personalizing Mike's concepts with audiences' expectations. His vast product line, used by individuals and organizations around the world, gives people the tools and resources for implementing theory into action. His seminars and workshops are attended by those who want how-to and hands-on techniques. His consulting and project facilitation services, utilizing his creative thinking and displayed thinking techniques, offer clients creative solutions to programs, products, and projects.
If you're captain of a ship, and you're standing up on the bridge, as anybody likes to say, and you're looking ahead, you see something coming towards you you don't want, so you call 50-degree turn to port, and the ship doesn't turn, so you say it again. 50-degree turn to port, still doesn't turn, so you say it again. 50-degree turn to the port, now you're getting mad, so you get a authoritarian, which is usually how people get a authoritarian. You're especially bothered because you just went to a team building course, and also you had a seminar at the lake and decided that everybody likes each other, and still they won't turn. Also, everybody has been empowered and still they won't turn. So this captain is frustrated, and just about the time he's ready to yell again, a young infant steps around who just come back from MIT, says, "Sir, the reason that we're not making the 50-degree turn is that under the conditions that we're under, our ship has a rudder that is only designed to make a 30-degree turn." He says, "Sir, no matter what kind of a leader you are, no matter how empowered we are, no matter how big our budget, no matter how fine of leaders we all are, the ship will never turn until we redesign the rudder."
Audiences all over the world invite Mike Vance to share his creativity, new thinking, and fresh ideas for enhancing people's creative abilities, stimulating entrepreneurial spirit, and finding original solutions to solve problems and seize opportunities.
When I ask Louis L'Amour, and when you get my book, you'll read about it. Do you know who I'm talking about? The Western writer. He was a friend of mine. We used to debate philosophy. I asked Louis, I said, "Louis, I talk a lot. What do you think keeps creativity alive and makes people out-of-the-box thinkers and innovators?" He said, "Oh, Mike, it's in the universe. The universe is creative, as Edison and Einstein and Fuller all said. The answers are out there if you look for them, because we have operating general principles of universal design integrity that we're trying to uncover." I said, "I know. Some people seem to uncover more than others." I said, "What do you think it is?" He said, "Mike, it's motivation." I said, "Well, I understand that too, but what motivates people?" And this is not me, this is Louis L'Amour says, "Oh, Mike, that's the simplest thing you ever asked me. Sex, passion, and desire." He said, "You take sex, passion, and desire out of the equation, and you dry up, you die. You die before you live, and you all know life is too long not to do it right. We live 2.5 billion seconds. That's a long time. The purpose of time is so that everything doesn't happen at once." And Louis L'Amour said, "You've got to keep sex, passion, and desire are the heart of the universe, the most ingenious thing." I said, "I'll never get it in the budget. I got to get it in the budget." And I've had people say, "Our CEO gets it in the budget all the time." But anyway, yeah, but please don't misunderstand. I'm not being facetious. Here's what he said. I want to challenge all of you. Go to Paris, stand up on the top of the Eiffel Tower, look at the Louvre and its river, at Pantheon, the Basilica of the Sacred Heart. Go over under Ian Payne's glass pyramid, study art, architecture, beauty, literature, sculpturing. He said, "Mike, take out sex, passion, and desire, and there won't be one thing in the Louvre. It'll be empty." And he said, "I don't mean carnal or prurient sex." He said, "I like that, but that's not what I mean." He said, "I am talking about the energy." So I want the last thing that you remember from me, start a kitchen for the mind. Go to Paris. See, we get through this convention, you go to Edison's house, slip back, and then you can get a direct flight to Paris, and stand on the top of the Eiffel Tower with somebody you love or want to love, and look out there, and then here is what will blow your mind. Some of you have seen it. There's a little room on the top of the Eiffel Tower, and in it is Thomas Edison as a mannequin. It's a room about as big as this table. Have any of you seen it? And you know what I'm talking about. And he's with Gustav Eiffel. When he won his 80th birthday, he wrote Dr. Eiffel, "I want to sleep on the Eiffel Tower. Would you put a room up there for me?" And they did. And he's up there at a telegraph key tapping out something. But I wondered when I got up there, what is he saying? Wouldn't you want to know? What would Edison be tapping out on the top of the Eiffel Tower going all over the world? I asked the people at the Eiffel Tower. They didn't know. I kept searching. I finally found out somebody who knew. Here's what it means. Edison was tapping out, and you'll see it at the end of this book, hello, hello, hello out there. Create something for us. Some of you know, and if you go over to Fort Myers, when he invented the phonograph, you know, he talked into a stylus, into a coil of foil, and he said, Mary had a little lamb. And then he cranked it back and it went, oh, 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 ah. And Edison said, hell no. I'm sure you've heard of this. And then he did it again and he repeated it, hell no. And what happened became contracted. And Edison popularized a new word called hello. So what Edison is sending to the top of the Eiffel Tower is, hello, hello, hello out there. Create something for us. And that is what you need to do to think out of the box. By the way, I brought it. Would you like to hear it? Here it is. That's the message.
No, no, no. Terrific.